If it's Sunday, it's the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
What's going on, Shauna?
Not much.
Do you always have this music playing wherever you go?
No, only when I'm here, but that's probably all I needed.
We should start off with some business. Hearst Ranch is the sponsor of today's show.
Yes, they are.
We have some really big sponsors, if you think about it. Sam Edwards, Edwards Hams in Virginia, TechServe, the Mac shop on 23rd Street. I mean, they were real, you know, visionaries to give us money. And look at what we're doing with the boar's head on the wall.
I know. I don't know whether to be afraid or pet it. I'm not sure what to do with that.
Just no sudden movements. It's not stable up there at all.
So don't pet it. It might hit the guy next to me.
So how was your week? What's been going on?
Week's been work. Just working.
How's Back 40?
Back 40's busy. As crazy.
How many jaw nuggets do you go through a week?
You should know that. I buy them from you. So I go through, 10 pounds, 15 pounds?
Yeah, like you get 20 jowls meaty.
Will I ever be on this show without you asking about the jowl nuggets?
If you make them less good, then maybe I'll move on. But you do definitely get a lot of this for your nuggets.
Thank you.
Well, let's do our Hearst drop. Okay, guys, are you ready in the back? I am going to drop sound effect C2. You guys ready? Nat, you ready?
You're listening to the You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch. www.hearstranch.com.
All right. So, well, this is a very, very exciting show. We have Wiley Dufresne and Dave Arnold on as guests in studio.
Yes, we do. We have some big names in house today.
I know. It's pretty serious. Have you eaten at WD and at French Culinary?
I went to French Culinary. Oh. And I haven't eaten since I went there 9 years ago. Sorry, I'll be right on that. And I have eaten at WD. It's been a couple years, but I have eaten there twice.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's one of the questions. It's like I want to ask a question about like destination restaurants, you know, versus, you know, and like what is the following of a destination restaurant kind of thing? Like, who are those followers, you know, versus a place like this that's just, you know, pasta and pizza?
Well, there's definitely a difference, and we can ask them that question.
Cool. All right. Well, any more sound effects?
What about you? I heard you were just on vacation.
Yes, I was in the Florida Keys. Mm. And I actually tasted those lobsters down there, which I liked a lot. They're those spiny ones, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the food is
bad.
No, it's fish, you know.
Grouper. I'm from Florida. It's bad.
Is it?
Yes. It's bad food. I'm sorry. It's.
But don't they just like cook fish fresh and grill it and then it's good? Like grease?
I don't even know. I mean, it's been 10 years since I've been out of Florida. But yeah, when I go home to visit, it's really funny because they try to do this whole Caribbean theme in all these restaurants because they're so close to the Caribbean, but it's just bad food.
Caribbean. This is as close as we have. There's rainforest in Caribbean, right?
Sure, maybe.
I'm sorry, we just got new sound effects, so I'm a little heavy on that. We used to just have those six sound effects.
Did you do the farm animals?
Yeah, we have pig snorting. And we have the saddest little sheep of all time. Anyway, well, we should get to serious stuff. We're going to take a... Well, actually, we might as well just go into it.
Yeah, we don't need to take a break. They're here.
Yeah, they're right here.
They're ready to go.
Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, I mean, I'll start it off with a quick question. Like, maybe Wiley and Dave, you could just tell us, like, where, you know, how you got to WD50 and how you got to French Culinary Institute and how you guys know each other, like, why you're both on at the same time today.
Wiley Dufresne, the chef owner of WD50 here, and I, too, was an alum of the French Culinary Institute, and a long time
FCI
ago.
FCI in the house.
Yeah, that's right.
A long time ago, and have been working here in Manhattan for, I don't know, 15, 16 years now.
Where were you before WD? Did you grow up in the restaurant ranks here in New York?
Prior to WD50, I was the chef across the street, actually, at 71 Clinton Fresh Food, and then before that, I spent many, many years working with Jean-Georges von Gerichten and many of his outposts, and then prior to that with Alfred Bortale of Gotham Bar and Grill.
How is Jean-Georges' restaurant group like different than other French restaurant groups, you know, like for instance Daniel Boulud or whatever? Does he have a particular thing he does that's different than other restaurants like his own?
Those types of questions might be better suited to Jean-Georges.
Okay.
but he's certainly doing a great job and has been a supporter and a mentor to myself and to the restaurant. I mean, he's one of the actual owners of the restaurant as well. So,
what was it like to open a restaurant across the street from a restaurant you were the chef at 71?
It was potentially fraught with I don't want to say disaster, but I was concerned about how it might go. But I had a lengthy discussion with the owners of 71, and they were very supportive, and it went well. I mean, I was sorry to see 71 go when it did. It's been reincarnated, you know, as the Fat Hippo right now, under some good people. But you know, they helped me a lot to get started, and they have continued to support WD-50. So right now it's, you know, we have a great relationship.
But was the menu different? Was it it was a completely different concept, or were you just did the same thing just a little bit more?
I think it's always been a state of evolution. You know, what I started there, I continue right now at WD-50. I think that's just it's been a natural evolution and progression that we've gone through.
How about progression? And then we'll get to Dave. Same types of questions. Evolution of that street. Clinton, I mean, you have seen it transform, right, over the past, how many years has it been?
It's been 10 years I've been on the street, yeah. So I've been accused of a lot of the transformation.
Oh, accused, yeah. In a good way or a bad way?
It depends on who you ask, I think.
Yeah, I would assume that.
But the street has changed, but that neighborhood has changed. If you look at sort of the history of that neighborhood, it's gone through a lot of different ethnicities, and I think that's part of the normal sort of ebb and flow of a tiny island.
Yeah, I mean, the city never stays the same. It's constantly transforming, including French Culinary Institute. I mean, that almost, I remember Dorothy for a while was being asked to open down by Ground Zero, you know, because the power of the French Culinary Institute can transform a neighborhood. How long have you been there, Dave?
I've probably been there about three years, maybe three and change. Something like that.
And what do you do with them?
I'm the director of culinary technology, so basically developing new techniques, ingredients, and equipment for chefs.
Wow.
Is that included in all the program, or is that a choice that people choose to take classes that...
Yeah, it's kind of strange for the kind of school that we are. I mean, we're not, you know, we're not a university. We're, you know, we're a cooking school. So it's kind of unusual to have someone like me there, because it's basically kind of, you know, just gravy. You know, the students, any student who's there can come work with me if they want to. There's a little bit in the standard curriculum. We teach a little bit of sous vide low temperature just because we think it's extremely important. And some of the newer ingredients get shuffled into the curriculum every now and again. But it's really kind of there to try and place us as kind of thought leaders in the cooking.
I kind of feel like I got
education.
Gypped a little bit.
Likewise.
I went there, it was very basic. It was very, there was no different courses. They didn't offer the wine. They did the bread program, the culinary program, and the pastry, and that was it.
Yeah, come back.
I'm good.
Just to hang out.
Oh, yes, I could do that.
Play with the centrifuge.
What kind of things would kids learn there if they did take your... Is it a class, or do you have an advanced class, a beginning class?
We teach a couple of classes that are actually not aimed at kind of beginning students. They're aimed more at chefs who want to learn new techniques. We teach a low-temperature and sous vide class. It's basically, you know, 2 days, come in, bang, we're going to teach you enough to at least start cooking in your own place. Mm-hmm. We teach one on kind of new ingredients like hydrocolloids, enzymes, things like that, things that are becoming a lot more popular, I think a lot more important. And that, by the way, I think has a lot of legs in the restaurant world, like the use of those ingredients.
Which one did you say?
Kind of hydrocolloids, new ingredients, new kinds of things. Things like the use of transglutaminase, which is a, you know, Wiley dubbed meat glue, things like that. And
that,
the last
that wasn't my term. I don't get full credit for that term.
Who came up with that?
Heston Blumenthal came up with term.
Nice.
Let's just be honest.
Nice.
Heston Blumenthal.
But in New York, anyway, the two biggest users of this product were Wiley and Nils Noren, who runs the French Culinary's he's the head chef there. He runs it. And those two guys probably used for years like 90% of the meat glue that was being used in the city, and maybe even in the country. I don't know kind of how it was being used elsewhere.
Why? What service does it provide a chef?
Oh, a lot. So, Wiley used it for a lot of famous things, which he can talk about. But even like a normal chef who doesn't want to kind of push the envelope so much, it allows you to produce a more consistent product for your customer. You know, every portion is going to look exactly the same, cook exactly the same, which means higher quality for your customer. And another benefit is you can save money because you're not going to waste as much off your product when it comes in because you can utilize more of it.
So how does one go about finding these products, and somebody who might not be in culinary school go about using it? Let's, for example, me, if I'm, because I'm completely lost. When I
you
think
don't
about
have meat glue at your house?
No. I wouldn't even know
that's
how
so
to
weird.
Begin to use it.
I have
a few
it
years
my house.
Ago that might have been normal, but
I know I gotta update myself.
But once you start using it though, it's like, oh man, just glue that, glue it together, fix it, make it right, make it good. You
I
know
did
what I mean?
Research it once online, but I was too afraid to tempt it.
what part of the process does meat glue get thrown into the meat?
Typically, when the protein, whether it be meat, fish, or poultry, generally speaking, are raw in the raw state.
Okay. And it serves to, is it a gustatory addition to it, or does it serve a purpose intellectually or something to, or?
Well, it can serve a purpose intellectually, but it's a it's a functional ingredient. I mean, it literally, meat glue, again, not my term, but a very useful and appropriate term, you can take, as Dave's mentioned, let's say two tail pieces of salmon that normally would either go to the staff or be chopped for tartare or ground or whatever, can be fused together over time and can become a usable product. And that's its most sort of basic application, but I think there's meat glue 2.0 and 3.0 and we're working on 4.0.
Wow. I'm still working on Windows 5.0. I don't even know.
Well, but you make a burger, right?
I do.
And you could easily do some really interesting things adding meat glue to your burger in terms of increasing fat content and things like that so that the burger would still hold together.
But do you think that would at all compromise what I'm about at Back 40, keeping things natural and as close to their normal state?
Your body has transglutamine. Your body produces that enzyme every time, all the time. I mean, if you tear a muscle, let's say, and your body needs to repair it, your body has those enzymes present
meat
in its
glue.
System.
Meat glue.
Well, there are very few. Like, one of the misconceptions is that these things that are being used are somehow unnatural. There are of a small handful of these products that are not natural in the sense that they're not naturally occurring.
Yeah,
I mean, like some of those things. But
I mean, natural is a dicey word too. I mean,
right.
We can talk the whole hour about the word natural.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, natural written on a package in the grocery store is a lot different than natural.
Meat glue is processed on the same order that actually less so than sugar. It's actually less processed than sugar.
Correct.
What exactly does meat glue come from?
They. Ajinomoto, the good folks that make a lot of MSG, found a soil bacteria that just happens to produce a ton of it. And so they just grow it. This bacteria sits there and ferments it, just like alcohol is produced. And then they just spin the bacteria down, and you're left with the enzyme. Mm-hmm. And that's all it is. It's a protein. And, it just comes from this bacteria that grows. I mean, it's no less natural than alcohol or the byproducts of, I don't know, miso fermentation, anything like that.
This is, hold on, we're going to...
We talk about food.
Nice.
That's actually
that's
someone else's. Yeah, it goes on. It's the Snacky Toons' guys. Well, this is very interesting. This is going to be tough for our producer, Jack Inslee, and our engineer, Nat Wiener, to put all these tags in. There's a bunch of new concepts here. But, I mean, I wanted to ask, since we're on this kick, like, Cryo Machine... Why is a cryo machine? Can we just like drop some tool ideas? Like I heard about the anti-griddle and the cryo machine. Why don't more chefs sous vide? And why is a cryovac machine important in your kitchen?
Well, I mean, we don't use, you mentioned anti-griddle. That's not something that we use at WD-50.
Okay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that product, but it's not that piece of equipment, I should say, but that's not something that we use. But vacuum packaging is very useful on a myriad of levels. I mean, it's incredibly useful for storage, for cooking, low temperature cooking, certainly. It's sort of endless in terms of its applications.
The health department doesn't like it.
Why?
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, they have some rules and regulations, and if you're able to follow them, which we do, mm-hmm. I mean, we're certainly HACCP certified. I believe we have four, maybe five at this point HACCP plans that are approved by the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
But you have to have the plan. In New York City only?
Yeah. Maybe some other locales, but here is the big... Here's where it happened. Here's
so
where
you,
it all
you
went
have
down.
To get this plan written up.
A HACCP plan, explained to our listeners, is a basically safety plan for the eyes within the eyes of the government for your restaurant.
It's beyond that. It's complete logbooks. You have to store information on it's traceability and verification that you followed your procedures. The procedures are designed to increase the safety of your product, and then there's a verification process, and that's kind of the bear, right, Wiley?
Yeah, I mean, you must be HACCP certified in your meat processing.
The slaughterhouse is.
Yeah, exactly.
And Palafrita is.
Exactly, they're all HACCP certified.
I just hear those horror stories of the health department walking in some restaurants and throwing away, tons and tons of food with people trying to skirt the HACCP certified because it's an expensive process, right, to get done?
I don't think any more. It's no more of a burden financially or otherwise than many of the other good, safe guidelines you're meant to follow in any sort of restaurant.
To be honest, I think the reason, and I can kind of say this because I'm not in a position of having to deal with them on a daily basis like Wiley is, but I think that they weren't expecting that chefs would go through the trouble of getting the HACCP plan. I think when they started dealing with this, HACCP plans for chefs, I think they thought they were going to make it so complicated that chefs would just stop using the techniques rather than go through all the trouble of getting a HACCP plan, because I didn't think they understood the culinary advantages and how much chefs really liked the process. So, people like Wiley, people like, Dan Barber, Dave Chang were like, I'm going to get the HACCP plan. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think they were expecting such a response.
What about sous vide was so important that it was worth fighting through all those bureaucratic red tape to figure it out?
I just think that it's a piece of equipment that, while I wouldn't say it's extremely new, it's relatively new. It has provided us with the incredible opportunities from the way we can cook meat and fish and poultry, from the way we can work with vegetables and fruits. We are, through the help of people like Dave, finding new applications for the equipment literally daily. But I think there's a lot that can be done with it that's very simple and very interesting. There's a lot that can be done with it that's pretty complicated. And there's a lot that we haven't even figured out yet.
I mean, the new uses are really the reason why it's so interesting. The machine's been around since the 70s or even maybe early 70s. But, the fact of the matter is back then it was used for economic reasons, just, so your product lasted a little bit longer, you could keep it longer, things like that. I think that's why it didn't take off, because it wasn't perceived as a quality increasing thing. It was just for economics. People thought you were shortchanging them by vacuum packing stuff. Now... Mm-hmm. It's switched. People are using it to make a higher quality product. It's actually a tool to make good food. It's not a tool just to save a nickel.
And how does it improve the food? Because it gives more of the essence of what the thing is itself? Or does it,
us, it's about, like many much of the equipment in a kitchen, it's another addition to our arsenal. It's another way to prepare a piece of meat. We have multiple ovens. We have... We don't just have your standard operating oven. We have, ovens that you can control the moisture in, the dry heat, the wet heat, aromas. And this is an addition, I think, to a kitchen that is very useful in terms of how we can affect the texture. It gives us more options. I mean, could we cook without it? Absolutely. Do we cook without it? Absolutely. But having it is just increasing our arsenal and our possibilities in terms of how we can manipulate proteins, I think.
Right, but sous vide isn't the big revolution that's happening. It's low temperature cooking. It's the temperature control that's the big thing. With the exception of vacuum infusing and kind of like a lot of, which I love, it's one of my favorite things, where I use the vacuum for. With the exception of that, most of 90% of the work that I do protein wise, I could do without a vacuum machine, but I still need the temperature control.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I still have a couple of other like tool type things that you use, but maybe we should get into that, what we were talking about, the creative process. Like, how does that happen, like, between the two of you with tools? Like, is there a need? Is it the concept first, or does the new technology come?
Well, I have a question. I saw a video online where he was creating a piece of equipment for you, and it didn't explain what it was, and I was very curious to know what it was doing.
Well,
is it working right now?
I can answer both of those questions. Okay. I mean, it doesn't follow a pattern. Our creativity is not linear. It's not. Sometimes it's the piece of equipment that leads to the dish, and sometimes it's a dish that requires a piece of equipment or a concept that requires a piece of equipment, and that's what you're making reference to, the video. It was a piece of equipment that we still have that Dave made multiple prototypes for when we were trying to basically create sort of a teardrop that had the flavor of milk. It was liquid milk on the inside wrapped in a gel of coffee on the outside. We were trying to make cafe con leche, basically, and I had been researching some old patents and come across some information and then contacted Dave. This was very early on in our relationship, actually.
By the way, hint to those listening, like, read patents.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great source of inspiration. And
Hachi machi.
Read patents.
They're free online.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And these guys have worked out a lot of really cool stuff.
Are you using that equipment now? Is it working for you?
I think that piece of equipment is very cool, and we were very close to getting it to do what we wanted, given what we both knew at the time. And I think now that we both know more than we did then, and we've been able to create similar effects not using that particular piece of equipment, but without having gone through that, we probably wouldn't be where we are now. So it's a very useful piece of equipment.
Right. You know, and my dad, he's an engineer, has a saying, you know, there's no partial credit in engineering, but I think in this case it's not really true, because we learned so much just by building it and testing it, mm-hmm. not just about that one piece of equipment, but, you know, how the gum systems we were using work, you know, how the whole process of deposition works. We learned a lot just by building it. So even if the piece of equipment isn't being used now, it was a useful exercise for all of us.
Absolutely.
So, but how does the process go? Like, you have a team of people that help research something whenever you come up with an idea or something you want to try that's basically off the wall, and you say, okay, let's get together and try this for the next 3-4 months?
Well, I mean, a team would be an exaggeration. I have a team, and they're responsible for all sorts of preparation daily and things like that. I mean, the way we work in the restaurant is it's a group. Everybody contributes. Everybody contributes to the ideas, and the creativity is not linear. It doesn't start in one particular place. It could be a meal I had. It could be something I read. It could be a conversation I've had with Dave. It could be an idea, a piece of equipment that Dave is excited about. It could be something that one of my cooks wants to try, and it sort of grows from there. At the moment, we don't have anybody dedicated solely to research and development, although over the 6 years we've been open, we have had research R&D teams at various times, and we're hoping to get back to that shortly.
It's funny, like, everyone with us wants to be a forager. They're like, can't I work with Heritage as a forager? Like, I'm sure with you, everyone like wants to be that science guy that comes up with all the technology, but in the end, it ends up being a group.
Those are the guys that want to work with Dave, actually.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah.
And did you guys have a warehouse somewhere,
I wish.
Like with an anvil and like all these like things? Like, does that exist?
You know, one of the issues, like, I love New York. I love it. But you know, it's so hard to actually do anything here, to make anything. It's so, if you have to make something with your hands and you live in Manhattan, mm-hmm. and you don't have a shop, it's very difficult or expensive. It's either hard or expensive. One of the two.
Elliot Coleman, we had him on the Heritage Radio Network, and he was talking about, like, as a farmer, like, finding something he just needed. So he would approach the tool company, and yeah, it ends up being this kind of, like, 2 years later, the, forget what type of pitchfork it is or something like that it ends up rotating through the soil. But it's an interesting collaboration.
Well, and when you're developing a piece of equipment, you have to go through a bunch of revisions of it, mm-hmm. you know, and each revision costs XYZ plus this many hours. There has to be a return. That's why it's hard to get new things in a kitchen, because you need to put a lot of energy into it, and, you know, you need to get enough menu items out of it. It has to be useful enough. It has to justify the floor space,
right.
You know.
Well, we are going to take a 1 minute break, and then we'll be back to talk more. And we're also going to have a 5 minute call in from Brian Kenny, who just got the Anaheim Convention Center to start buying all sustainable grass-fed meats, which is a pretty good institutionalized
That's
dining
very good.
Thing. So that'll be 5 minutes, but we'll be back with Dave and Wiley.
This is Heritage Radio Network in Brooklyn. We're here at Roberta's, and I'm Shauna Pacifico.
I'm Donnie Atlantico. Sorry.
Again.
I know.
You with the bad jokes.
That wasn't funny the first time either.
No, it wasn't.
Week. I'm Patrick Martins.
And we're here with Wiley and David. And we were, I was curious, we mentioned a little bit about destination restaurants. So you're obviously, WD is a destination restaurant. But you also probably have a following. What is it? Is it more of a destination, or is it a neighborhood restaurant?
Well, I mean, I think the term destination restaurant is one that I don't even fully understand. I mean, it's a lot easier to get to my restaurant than it is to get to Roberta's. I mean, no disrespect meant to Roberta's. This was more of a destination.
Oh, wait. Sorry. I want a booze. It doesn't matter.
I mean, I always think it's funny. I mean, it's a bit of a testament to New Yorkers and how little they like to travel. I mean, it's an 11-mile by 2-mile island, so really everything's pretty close if you compare it to just about anywhere else. But people do feel like we are a bit out of the way, that we're hard to get to.
Well, more about not just out of the way, but you're also offering a different type of cuisine that's not, let's say, everybody's, you it's know, not Monday night dinner.
They're what they're not familiar with.
It, well, yeah, but I think that as more people, I mean, we have people that come close to once a week, so that's great for us. And I think it's a matter of people getting a little bit more comfortable with the terminology, with what we're doing, and understanding it, and realizing that it's not so. Such a destination, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Is it intellectual versus like the where in the spectrum of intellectual versus gustatory? You know, are you always 100% on the gustatory, or are you also willing to take? I know you weren't you a philosophy major at Colgate?
Colby, please.
Colby, sorry.
I don't think that any restaurant's going to be successful if the food doesn't taste good. I mean, that's where it starts and where it ends. I mean, we want the food to taste good. So we're not trying to be an intellectual endeavor that occasionally, you know, serves some good stuff. I mean, we want to make food that tastes good. I think every restaurant wants to make food that tastes good, and that's where it begins and that's where it ends. And having some fun in the middle.
100%. And I mean, next is, how is your restaurant line different than a traditional chef's restaurant line? Or is there no difference whatsoever? Like, people could walk into your kitchen and see the usual suspects in their positions.
I think that's true. I think you could walk into WD-50 and everything would make sense and everything would seem normal to anybody that had spent some time in professional kitchens. I mean, you've been there.
I've been there. It's a beautiful kitchen.
But it's there's nothing. I think it's more about what we do with the equipment that we have that might not be familiar to everybody.
Once service starts, it's pretty much the same. You have your meat cooks, you have your fish cook, you have your vegetables, garmanger.
Absolutely. The restaurant's broken down in a very traditional way. Again, I think it's about using the ingredients and the equipment that we have in ways that are different, interesting, newer, maybe that might separate what we do from other restaurants, but the format is no different.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things, like, most people have not been to, most of our listeners have not been to your restaurant, I bet, you know, if they're not from New York. So, I mean, what would people see there? Like, what are your usual mainstays, but that are also truly unique to your restaurant, maybe?
Well, we have a traditional a la carte menu with at this point, I think 8 appetizers, and we have 9 entrees, 4 fish, 4 meat, and then we have a tasting menu that has 11 items on it, and a dessert menu with, I think, 8 items, and a dessert tasting menu as well. And so that's a pretty standard layout for restaurants. But I would encourage people to go to the website, take a look at the website.
What is that website?
WD50.com. And you can see we've just put next week, actually, we'll have 15 new dishes on the menu.
15
new dishes that we just photographed over the last 2 weeks. So
so you're changing the menu.
No, these dishes are already on the menu, but we've just finished photographing them all. So our website will be updated next week, and you'll get to see a lot of new photos of the current menu.
What are you most excited about on your menu? Is there ever, I remember whenever you were doing the Eggs Benedict, and I went in to eat with Marcellus, and you were very excited about that. Is there any one thing that you're super excited about?
No, I mean, I'm always excited. I'm excited about the restaurant. I enjoy being there. I'm excited about the process. We're always, I would like to think we're always doing something that speaks to a particular time and moment of the restaurant and the history of the restaurant and is reflected, a reflection of the restaurant.
Fantastic.
Great.
What are your favorite tools? I mean, can you talk about some other ones? I mean, I know that that's one of your, or is there a tool you're working on or something? Or is there something that technology is just not there yet, but that everyone is waiting for?
You should talk to Dave about that. I think Dave is a good person to chime in on that stuff.
I mean, the real problem is some of my favorite pieces of equipment are not really feasible for widespread use in restaurants. Like my favorite piece of equipment is a rotary evaporator, right? It allows me to do vacuum distillation. The problem is that all the good products you make with it are illegal because distillation is illegal, and that doesn't stop me, but it's tough to do it in a restaurant where your liquor license might be at stake. So there's not that many chefs who, you know, use it right now. It's also extremely expensive.
What's it called?
Rotary evaporator. It's a piece of lab equipment that basically allows you to do distillations at extremely low temperatures. So I can do an herb distillation that tastes incredibly fresh and green and beautiful. It's, but again, completely illegal, right? I can also do, like, you know, Grant Akitz has been getting some play now. He got a rotovap at Alinea, and so he's been doing hot pepper distillations. And the interesting thing is that the aroma and flavors come through, but not the spiciness. Now, we do that and have been doing it for a long time with liquor, right? But it's just not legal to do it. But all the best tasting stuff is with liquor, because the alcohol is such a better flavor carrier than the water. So, you know, first you got to spend the whatever 10 to 18 grand on your piece of equipment. Then you got to train a bunch of cooks not to break it, because it's extremely easy to break, and every part that breaks costs $500. Then you have to, you know, find a legal thing you can do with it. You know, so it's a pain in the ass, but it's my favorite piece of equipment. It allows me to do things that are impossible otherwise. Man, it's just a piece of magical equipment. I love it.
And tell me, really, for the home chef, just one last time, what will that piece of equipment do that they can't do with their regular equipment? It separates out.
You mean with their regular still? that's a piece of distillation equipment, so it's kind of interesting. But it's just the ability to create incredibly fresh tasting liquors, incredibly, incredibly fresh tasting, like beautiful, like clean, awesome stuff. I mean, it's, every time I use it, I'm happy. It makes me happy every time I use it. But, you know, we're using a centrifuge now, which also is not very friendly for the kitchen. A centrifuge, so a rotary evaporator is distillation. It separates based on basically how volatile, something wants to evaporate. And a centrifuge separates based on density. Now, the problem with centrifuging is that it's also an expensive game, and the yields can be quite low. But we're trying to figure out enough applications for a reasonably priced centrifuge such that a chef like Wiley might want to get one. So right now we're making incredibly fresh-tasting nut oils, right? So you can get a lot of nut oils on the market, but a lot of them don't really have a lot of flavor. We're grinding lots of nuts, spinning them ourselves, and kind of tweaking how hard and how fast we're spinning them to kind of figure out how much oil we're going to pull out of it, and thereby how much flavor we get out of it. And we're doing nuts that you don't normally get. We make a pecan oil that'll knock your socks off, and the Euro dudes who make a lot of these nut oils, they don't care about pecans, so they don't even make it. It's like one of the best nut oils, pecan oil, and the pecan butter that's left over makes peanut butter look foolish. You know, it's so good. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things that I like. These are the kind of things I like to work on. You know, I don't really care whether people know the technology I'm using. I want them to like the product.
Right. And a centrifuge, it's like what astronauts go in, that thing that goes them so fast around.
Yeah, but much, much faster. You know, someone sold one of those on eBay for like $1.5 million a couple months ago, with one of the actual astronaut ones. But those aren't fast enough to, like, they're awesome to, like, you know, bend your face into weird pretzel shapes, but they're not fast enough to kind of separate out nut oil.
The G-Force ride at the fairgrounds.
Right. Or maybe they could get those speeds at the velodrome that they're building right next door.
Exactly.
Here.
We were doing a lot of clarification work in the centrifuge, but we've since come up with worked on techniques that have kind of made the centrifuge not necessarily so useful for clarification.
Is there more money in your kitchen with the equipment than most other kitchens? I mean, are you guys often like, we're waiting to invest in this next thing, or, you know, do we have enough applications for it that we want to spend $600,000 on something?
I certainly don't have $600,000 spending. And I don't have a rotary evaporator or a centrifuge, because I personally can't afford one right now. As Dave said, there needs to be more. I need to justify the cost a little bit more.
And the space.
The cost, the space.
It's still New York City.
One of the reasons we were drawn to hydrocolloids and things and enzymes is because they're very affordable. They're very, very affordable. They don't require really any special equipment that you wouldn't normally find, except for maybe a gem scale, some way of, you know, micro scale, but. Otherwise, they're very affordable. They don't require a lot of space. Fairly easy to work with once you do your homework and understand the way they work. And so that was why we got into it so early. You know, 6 years ago, we really invested a lot of time, but we didn't have to invest a lot of money in it. So, equipment is obviously important. I mean, we have a stove that is very expensive, certainly a lot more than a rotary evaporator.
Wait, and traditional,
by the way.
Yeah.
What kind of stove is that?
We have a Bonet Range.
One of the few in the city.
Bonet Range.
And the old school one.
You look all your face lit up. Yeah. Back 40 doesn't have one?
No.
But I mean, that's...
What's so unusual about it?
I don't think there's anything really that's that unusual about it.
It's like buying a Rolls Royce.
Right.
It's a nice piece of equipment.
Yeah. And if it breaks, some guy's like 10 minutes away.
I've only worked on a Bonet in the south of Portugal when I interned at a restaurant there. But it was, and we had to clean it with toothpicks, and like the to polish the brass and stuff like that.
You can come down and clean it with toothpicks anytime.
No, that's all right.
It's a short cab ride from back 40.
If anyone gets within 400 meters of it, you go. It sounds very expensive.
I heard you had to take, when you guys had it delivered, you had to take out the whole front of the restaurant or something like that. Is that?
We couldn't put the facade of the restaurant on, actually, until the stove was in.
Oh,
because
my God.
It's pretty big. It's like a really, really, really big pool table.
I have a question. So is there a certain kind of level of competition amongst chefs that do what you do, like at Alinea and other restaurants around the States that do that? Is there a, oh, crap, he came up with that first, or he...
Or what about Ferran Adrià and El Bulli? I mean, does he use those same types of things, too?
He does. I think he's quite well-stocked in his kitchen in terms of equipment and things like that, and his ability to have access to sort of the most cutting-edge things, certainly. I don't know. I mean, that would be a matter of chef-to-chef competition. I don't really feel a competition any more than I would feel with anybody who wants to be good at what they do. But I know it's not... we're not looking for a cure for something, so it's not like we're all necessarily chasing the same thing. And mm-hmm. whoever gets there first lays claim to it. It, you know, Grant is doing stuff with a rotary evaporator that I'm not. I don't have that piece of equipment, so he may come up with something neat. But it doesn't hurt my feelings, or I don't see it that way. I don't.
You
see
make
it
me
as a
feel bad now for all those hated things I thought about the Mangalista breed, the one breed that we don't sell. No, I'm kidding. I know. No, it's true. The competition, plus it's a different city.
Are they too hairy for you? You don't like those hairy pigs?
Those hairy pigs.
I find the cooking world is very competitive among chefs in a proper kitchen. They're very competitive and always racing to get to the top or to be the next promoted.
The next jowl nugget?
Kitchens are a competitive environment. I will certainly agree with that. But I think on a larger scale, I don't necessarily see it that way.
Who else does, I mean, in the country, I mean, in the world, I've only really heard of Ferran Adrià and then the guy at Alinea and then you. I mean, is there a whole burgeoning movement, you know, that you see coming out of FCI that's going to take this to a new level?
Here's what's funny, right? I mean, people try to lump a bunch of things together using a lot of these new techniques and ingredients. Like, for instance, hydrocolloids, Wiley mentioned, are basically a whole group of ingredients that have kind of been given a bad name because they've been used industrially to make food kind of cheaper for a long time. But people like Wiley have started using them to make their food better, right? So what Wiley's doing with them is what Wiley's doing with them. But every single four-star restaurant in this city uses them. Every single one. Okay, so it's not like, and no one goes to those, you know, places necessarily to get something that's hyper modern or cutting edge, right? They're going to get a 4-star meal. Now, the reason is because these products help your food, you know, help you make better food. They're just another tool in your toolkit to help you make better food. Now, there's a very smaller group of people trying to do what Wiley is doing, where, you know, he's making delicious food, but he's also interested in learning all the time. Wiley's incredibly curious and creative, and mm-hmm. I think that shows in his cuisine. So it's not that Wiley's cuisine is what it is because he uses new ingredients. It's Wiley is who he is. He's making the food that he wants, and because he's so creative and likes to, you know, research a lot of avenues, he's using a lot of these new ingredients and equipment. And I think that's the difference between people who are trying to do this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not the newness of the equipment that makes it important. That's the result of who they are, that they're using these things. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we are going to take a 10-second break, and then we're going to have a little brief segment about institutionalized dining and then come back for a 10-minute conclusion. This is The Main Course.
Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Moby, baby. He was in here for Snacky Tunes.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's good. He has a tea company. Teeny Tea, something like that.
What?
He's affiliated with food.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Although I think he might be a vegan.
He is a vegan.
Sadly.
So then I'm also going to drop this one. Anyway, no, vegans can be all right. So
I disagree. Sorry.
All right. Jeez. We have a guest on the line, Brian Kenny. Brian, big sponsor, big friend. Are you around?
Yes, I am, Patrick. Awesome. And I'm a vegan.
Welcome.
Nobody knows I'm a vegan.
Sorry about that.
Tell us, you are the ranch manager for the Hearst Ranch in California, largest land easement in the country. And I want to know, what is the big news with the Anaheim Convention Center? I just got that press release.
Well, we sold them a herd of cattle and 75 head of cattle for a pilot program to basically use only grass-fed beef, only Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef in their menu options for probably about 4 months. And we put together... We helped the chef. We had the executive chef there, Otis Humer, and Jim Tripp, who's the general manager, and Debbie Giuliani, who's the sales manager, up to the ranch in San Simeon in the beginning of July, and showed them the cattle. And we did a tasting of different kinds of meat on the ranch, and they came up with some really interesting menu options. And we actually, I took my team down to Anaheim about 2 weeks ago for a sales meeting with 30 of their top customers. And the Anaheim Convention Center, their customers are like the NAMM show, which is the National Association of Music Merchants, the Natural Foods Expo, you know, big, big, big shows. And so it went really well. I think it's a really fascinating concept. We had been selling them individually quick frozen beef, grass-fed beef patties for about 4 years, and they buy a lot of them. But that
doesn't necessarily use all the parts of the animal, even though getting rid of the ground is very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's just ground beef. But, you know, the point I kept driving home to them is that, you know, we are operating in, although we have 150,000 acres of rangeland, which is a vast amount, we're operating within a finite set of resources, and we have a finite supply. And I got them familiar with the cutout of cattle, and they were buying ground beef, so they were buying a lot of chuck and some round and a lot of trim. But there were also the middle meats and the brisket and flat iron and all that stuff available. And if they could commit to buying a certain number of head worth of beef, which is essentially what they bought, was the red meat from 75 head. They weren't buying live cattle per se. And we're going to sell. We're going to run a meat program for them, basically.
Well,
but it's bound to the resource.
Besides the fact that they're buying the whole animal, which is great, especially for farms and what it means for other farms. I mean, for our listeners out there, it's very unusual that a huge institution like a convention center would go whole hog, no pun intended, and switch, right? So it's a kind of pioneering first, almost.
Yeah. Well, it took 3 years to get it to happen, and it's pioneering because these are the Anaheim Convention Center is really on the cutting edge of sustainability. So they adopted the fish, Monterey Bay Aquarium seafood watch list about 4 years ago. So they were an early adopter of that. And they've gone to all corn-based, biodegradable plastic replacement products, and they're really on the cutting edge of a lot of these things. And
hopefully, this is what'll happen. It'll take off. Right,
that's
Brian?
That's what we're hoping for. You know, the hardest part, Patrick, of this whole deal. You and I have talked a lot about what should happen and what does happen, and the vast divide between the subjunctive should and the indicative did or does. The hardest part about putting this deal together was setting it up in such a way so that the food, you know, all the cost management equations still worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, of course, because if not, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, and that would have been the death of it. So now the challenge is we've done some things that are that are very much non-standard in that institutional dining niche. And so the challenge is going to be to make it so that, you know, the larger entities involved don't get nervous, which is always the case with change. It's great to come up with something, you know, it's like, congratulations, you just started a revolution, now control it and keep everybody from losing their heads.
Well, if it helps at all, I've decided to have the Heritage staff meeting at the Anaheim Convention Center.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so we want your briskets and stuff.
Yeah, we'll do something for that for sure.
Well,
yeah,
thanks, Brian, for being on. I know it's a Sunday early out where you are. This has been a special show. We have Wiley and Dave here, and you're a big sponsor and did a big thing in Anaheim. So thanks for breaking the news here on HRN. That's congratulations on your success.
You got it, and all the best, all you guys out there behind Roberta's.
Thanks, Brian. All right. Well, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's good for them.
Institutions are, you know, I think chefs have become an institution. Like, you know, 100, 200 great chefs in New York can now affect 500 farms. Likewise, you know, Madison Square Garden could probably affect 500 farms.
Or more.
Yeah. And they only need to dedicate one of those institutions. It's not like all Aramark has to change.
Uh-huh.
They just need one kind
of
flagship.
Well, why can't all of Aramark change?
Well, they don't even have, I mean, these are the first flagships even.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a good step. And, you know, now if they could do that in upstate New York, you know, and say, hey, every beef producer, just bring your beef to the slaughterhouse and our, you know,
mm-hmm.
big company can eat all that food. It'd be pretty cool. So hopefully they can expand that. So we have another 7-8 minutes with Wiley and Dave. And do you have any other questions? I mean, I have.
No, I'm stumped for a question right now.
Tell us about Dewey and what it's like spending all your time in, like, you know, one place. Like, you haven't, I'm sure you've been tempted to.
Well,
but
who's
open.
Dewey?
Oh, Dewey is Wiley's dad and the bookkeeper, accountant. I don't know what other things he does.
The guiding light of WD-50.
Guiding light. I mean, it's a real family affair. I mean, does that is that inspiring to, you know, have friends and family all in that one space for all those years?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's no greater ally that you can have than your dad standing there and making sure that you know, no one has my back more than my father in the restaurant. That goes without saying. I mean, he's looking out for me when I'm not even looking out for me. So that's a great thing. But I think, like any family business, it's fraught with some complications and things like that. But I, having my dad around is a great thing. And I certainly am lucky that I have someone who I can trust no matter what, and who is like I said, looking out for my best interest and the restaurant's best interest.
And you guys are kind of a family affair, right? You're married to the same sister powerhouse?
Yeah, the sisters, yeah, different ones. Yeah, but we never know. We both married into the Carpenter family. They make some badass sisters, the Carpenters do.
What about these the Carpenter family and molecular gastronomy? I mean, was there something there in their upbringing?
Wow. Well, you opened up a big can of worms with the molecular gastronomy term in the last couple of minutes, not giving us the time to punch our way out of it. But
well, let's talk. We have like 6 minutes.
Go ahead, punch your way out of
molecular
it.
Molecular gastronomy. Tell us, what is that? Is that the right word?
You shouldn't have said that, Patrick.
Yeah. No, it's a terrible term. It's
yikes.
Here's the no. And it's not any. Anyone's fault. It's been used quite a bit, but there's a couple of problems with it. One, it sounds disgusting. It doesn't sound like anything you want to eat. It doesn't sound delicious. No one says, hey, let's go out and have some molecular food tonight. Very few people do. Exactly. You know, whenever you describe food, whenever you describe food, it's good to use terms that sound delicious.
Okay.
The other problem is
so what's a better word?
Well, the other thing. Well, but before I even know that, it's not even accurate. I mean, like, either everyone's manipulating molecules or no one is. And you know, people who are using new techniques are basically using lots of new techniques, some of which aren't even science. Like, you know, I'll use stuff from homebrewers. You know, I'll use anything. It's basically this kind of creativity that's happening. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with molecules.
So what should we call it?
Yeah.
Delicious food.
Yeah, delicious food.
But I mean, there is something different. I mean, it's not.
But it was a term.
It's a technique, though.
It was a term coined by scientists to describe the work that they were doing and continue to do. It has nothing to do. I'm not a scientist. What I'm doing is not necessarily scientific. Dave is, well, Dave is Dave.
And well, if you want to see, if I'll plug my blog for one second. If you want to see what I do for a living, go to cookingissuesblog.com.
Cookingissuesblog.com. Yeah. But you're not Italian. You're not American. Or maybe you are. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Like, you're not French, or are you? I mean, are you elements of all those? Like, what? Where would you want to see yourself listed in an encyclopedia table of contents?
I mean, modern American, contemporary American. I mean, we're all American, right? I mean, since we have effectively relocated the indigenous people, we're now all Americans. So I modern American, contemporary American. I mean, I don't really care what you call it, to be honest with you. I think it's other people that need to give it a name and a title. But
right, just not that one.
Yeah. Now when I go to WD, I'm going to be like, let's go to that food institution.
No, that place makes appetizers. It's like fun and creative. Oh, you know what I mean?
It's a great restaurant.
Where do you see WD in 10 years, 20 years? Where do you see this cooking going?
The lease will be up, so that's a good question.
There'll be a centrifuge.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I'd like to have a centrifuge, but I'm waiting for Dave to tell me that I can't live without one. so far, I think I can. But, you know, I'd just like to see us continue to move forward. I mean, we know more about food today than we did 5 years ago, than we did 10 years ago. And I think we have a curiosity that I hope will endure, and we'll just continue to learn. I mean, this process, this restaurant has made me a more knowledgeable chef, which is, I think, ultimately made me a better chef. Understanding food has allowed me to cook it more respectfully, more responsibly, and has also given me just a greater understanding of what's happening to the food as I do cook it, which I think is the end goal of any chef, to become more informed about the food you're working with.
And one last question. I know it's absolutely absurd. We really needed more than 1 hour. And hopefully you guys will be back and hopefully do your own shows and stuff one day. But on the slow food level, are there things that are not, quote unquote, traditional ingredients? And do you have some of the more Nazi, hardcore, sustainable left people being like, that's a toxin or something like that, but it's something you need for what you're doing?
There are very few things that we use, I think, that anyone, if they thought about it, would have that much objection to. And, you know, I don't ever use, I know Wiley never uses anything that we think is even slightly harmful to the customer, ever. You know what I mean? But I think a lot of this, you know, a lot of this is a false dichotomy. Wiley's at the farmer's market every, you know, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are using
these. And Saturday.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I mean, people who are using these ingredients care deeply about their ingredients and where they come from. So it's a completely false dichotomy. If you use any sort of anything like sugar, anything like that, it's no more processed than, you know, half the stuff that we're using, which are basically seaweeds and seeds and, you know, roots and, you know, sap out of trees. I mean, that's where this stuff comes from. It's not like, it's not some crazy stuff. Many of them have been used for thousands of years, at least hundreds of years, many of them.
So we just have to tell these people to stop doing this. Oh, that sounds like a good one. Exactly. Well,
one last thing. It's not the ingredient. It's why you're using it. If you're using an ingredient to make food cheaper or crappier, then you're doing a bad thing. If you're using something to make it more delicious, it's a good thing.
That's an excellent tag. If you're using it to make it more delicious, it's a good thing. Well, it has been a real honor. I mean, I was like a little nervous before
I saw
today's
you.
Interview.
Were very nervous.
I was like, I was sweating through my man jellies. It was really crazy.
Oh, you mentioned the man jellies.
So, anyway, thanks guys for being on, and it'd be great if you guys came back either on the show or on another one. So, and that's WD50, which is 50 Clinton Street,
right
in Manhattan,
not the lubricant.
And then the French Culinary Institute, you know, is that. Institute of Culinary Education.com?
I think we're FrenchCulinary.com. Just like all one big mouthful of a URL, FrenchCulinary.com. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. It's been really, really enlightening to talk to you guys.
It certainly has.
And we will be next week back on the main course.
On the main course.
Cool. All right. Let's roll to music.
Thank you.
today, we're faced with the same issue.